Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Katie Galley, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. Katie, how was your weekend?
It was good. I had a good weekend. No complaints.
Any funny stories? Any workout? Good workouts?
On Saturdays at 8, I do open gym, and we always do something called a monster mash.
Right.
And it's a mash of three different workouts put together.
You pull them out of a hat?
No.
Random?
Well, you could do that. I've done that before. But it's a CrossFit gym called CrossFit Linchpin comes out with one every week.
And so, just copy them?
Yeah, we copy them. You do one workout, you rest 5 minutes, do another, rest 5 minutes, and do another. It takes
why
about an
five
hour.
Why 5 minutes of rest?
I don't know why it's 5 minutes, but
seems
I think it's
like
just
a long time.
A good amount. Well, it's not really.
Goes by
you
fast.
Would think so, but it's not. Yeah.
Well, we got a big show today.
Yeah, we do.
We got Christopher Bean. Chris Bean from Ackerman Security Systems. Welcome, Chris.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, people in Atlanta are familiar with Ackerman, but why don't you share a little bit about the Ackerman story? What are you doing for folks?
My name is Christopher Bean. I'm the general manager for the residential market of Ackerman Security right here in our core market in Atlanta, mm-hmm. Georgia. Ackerman started in 1967. Charlie Ackerman was the founder of our company.
So there's a real person named Ackerman.
He is a real man, and he actually recently passed within the last calendar year.
Did you meet him?
I never had the opportunity to meet him. He had sold the business to some prior owners, but we kept the company name intact for name recognition. But he had a very interesting story. He was actually shot and left for dead in his own home. And he lived through the ordeal. He later encountered the burglar, and he decided, I want to create a security company. He felt if he had had a security system, maybe he would not have been a victim. So it was really his mission. And
what was he doing before?
Real estate.
So he was just a real estate person?
And he continued doing real estate.
Wow.
And built an empire on that on the side.
Man, so on the side he said, I'm going to do a home security. Was it primarily home security at that time?
Residential security, but in the late 60s and early 70s, it was primarily for affluent homeowners. They were very expensive. So he created one of the first alarm system models that was affordable to the average homeowner.
And then what was it prior to that? Like what was out in the market before he did his thing? Do you know?
Prior to that, it was custom high-end security systems. People would spend thousands and thousands of dollars, even at that point in time, for security systems.
Mm-hmm. And then because it wasn't, there was no economies of scale, everything was custom for like the rich person to protect their house.
It was very custom, but at that time, the technology was also very limited.
Mm-hmm.
Key switch arming, a lot of technologies that we just don't use anymore. You might see them in a museum. You would not want to use them in your home in our modern time.
So then what was he modeling this service after?
He built his model on a custom design. There were not many nationwide models at that time, other than a few companies that you might recognize that are still around today,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't have the market saturation and the customer base and the technologies that we're using today. So he kind of pioneered custom designed, affordable pricing options for the average homeowner.
And then how did it evolve into kind of a super affordable mass business?
Over time, when the technology had come up closer to its current state and the manufacturers had everything dialed in to where a company could systematize and streamline their process and make it affordable to the average homeowner, at that point in time, he used that to help people customize the protection in their home. But one of the large differentiating factors that Ackerman specialized in was keeping the monitoring in-house. Most companies...
What does in-house mean?
In-house means that the security company, the alarm provider, actually monitors their own accounts. For example, Ackerman, we own our own monitoring facility. It's right here in Atlanta, Georgia. We have some very prestigious credentials within the monitoring space, but
mm-hmm.
most alarm companies subcontract to third-party facilities, so they can't control or guarantee the service because it's not in-house.
So then their people who are monitoring could be anywhere on the planet nowadays?
That is true. Most of the third-party monitoring facilities for American alarm systems are either across the country, Canada, south of the border. In some cases, they are indeed in India and other places abroad.
And then Ackerman, though, part of their culture is to just say, we're controlling all this. We're going to keep it in-house so we can control the quality.
We keep everything in-house. for a few reasons. Number one, when you have a large customer base, if you want to provide a higher level of customer service that you can control, you have to do it in-house, because we decided to voluntarily provide guarantees on our service where it's not required within the industry. There's no government regulatory agency that requires this upon us. It's not imposed upon us from the outside, but we guarantee the monitoring service. So, for example, we have two guarantees that are industry exclusive. One of them is called the seconds count guarantee, and that means that when the alarm goes off, Ackerman has people standing by 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We're going to respond to every alarm signal within 45 seconds or less, guaranteed. Otherwise, the monitoring is on the house. Another guarantee that we provide is called the no theft guarantee. And that means that in the event you were to experience a break-in, we're so confident in our system design and our brand recognition and the monitoring response as a deterrent for burglary and crime that we would actually reimburse your loss up to 200%.
So you're confident that if somebody tries to break in, that the authorities are, it'll be thwarted in some manner?
That's right. Every system is designed with three layers, if you will. We intend to deter the burglar.
Right, just so they don't even consider your home.
Exactly. We want it to look like your house is off the burglary market.
Right.
With the yard signs, the window decals as a visible deterrent. So your house appears as though if you were to break in, you're highly likely going to get caught, and people don't want to do that. They'll bypass those homes and move on to the neighbor who is
seemingly unprotected. Is there data that supports that?
That's correct. If you look at FBI crime reports, there are some that suggest up to 600% or six times less likely to have a break-in just by the appearance of a security system on site.
And then, so you mentioned there was more than one. So what are some other ways that you're good at what you do?
Deter, deny, and detect. Those are the three D's in the industry. So we mentioned deterrence just a moment ago.
Mm-hmm.
But denying the homeowner entrance into the house is something that Ackerman has recently been able to get into within recent years. And same thing with other companies in the industry. Now that electronic locks are integrating into the security systems, there's more automation available so we can help protect with physical security. So in the event the yard signs and the decals don't deter a would-be burglar, if they were to attempt to break into the home, we have physical locks that have keyless access. So you can't lock bump them. You have to have...
What does lock bump mean?
Lock bumping, if you go on YouTube, this is scary. Mm-hmm. When I learned about this years ago when we started selling electronic locks, I was unaware that this practice was in place on a lot of home invasions. If you ever hear of reports where a home invasion occurs and there's no sign of forced entry, lock bumping was probably involved. Criminals will take keys. They're probably locksmiths by trade. They can file down the keys in such a way when they put the physical key into your lock and they hit it with a hammer, literally within 2 to 3 seconds, they can flip the lock wide open and they're in the home. No sign of forced entry. They don't have to kick the door in. There's no sign of damage to the wood trim or the frame. So by
in a deadbolt lock?
Even in a deadbolt lock. There are a few classes of self-installed or professionally installed deadbolts that you can put in your home. They have to be lock bump proof. Quickset is one brand, for example. You can buy them. They have technology built in to prevent that.
So then the bad guy could just be looking for a brand that they know is vulnerable?
If it's branded. Many locks are not branded. Quickset and Yale, even for the end user, if you didn't want an electronic lock and you still want a physical key, there are preferences and reasons why people want that. But we would encourage everyone, if you have physical key locks at your house, whether or not they integrate with the system, definitely make sure that you have current technology to prevent the lock bumping.
Now, I see a lot of stuff at the stores, and there's one more D, right?
There was one more D, thank you. And the third D is detecting them. So if they're not deterred and we can't physically deny them into the house and they kick in the door, break the window, the third D would be detection. And that's where the alarm system comes into place. When people have the appropriate protection, sensors on the doors accessible from ground level, windows, if someone were to attempt to break into the home, it sets off the alarm, sends the signal to the monitoring facility, and then we can dispatch first responders out to the house for your protection.
So now, when the alarm goes off, it's going off and your people are the first line.
That's correct.
It doesn't go right to the police.
That is correct. many people think that when the alarm is initiated, it goes directly to your local police department or fire department. That is not the case. In almost all states in our country, it's required that the signal first be screened by a monitoring facility. Mm-hmm. So the monitoring center here in Atlanta for Ackerman Security, we receive those alarm signals. We're going to place outbound calls to the homeowner or the business owner, depending on the account type that we're monitoring for, and they would answer the phone. 99% of the time, nationwide, with all alarm users, they're false alarms. But
is it 99%?
It is, for false alarms.
Really? That's 99%?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And so what triggers it? Just some random noise or...
Yeah, there would be a few
human
key
error.
Factors. Human error and forgetfulness is really the largest reason, the culprit for false alarms. Sometimes the security systems don't have enough entry-exit delay time. And what that means, when the system is initially installed, set up, and programmed by a technician within the industry, they would set up an entry-exit delay time. So when you're coming home and you open the door, the system will beep, and you have a dedicated amount of time that you must enter your code into the keypad.
Right.
Otherwise, the siren would go off. So by setting up the appropriate entry-exit delay times, just remembering that the system was armed, we've got some customers, especially after it's first installed, getting acclimated to a new lifestyle, they have to put sticky notes on the door or something just to remind them for a period of time. So those are some common causes. And people with pets, if you have dogs and you have to take them out at night.
Oh, and you forget.
They forget that the system's armed, right, and they'll set off the alarms.
Now, is a code still the main way of disarming the, like remembering some numbered code?
Remembering a numbered code and entering it into a keypad to arm or disarm the system is still the most common practice, but nearly as common is the smartphone capability. It's becoming the norm that people want more control, more synergy and integration to where they can control it from their smartphone. They're pulling into the garage. They can arm and disarm it from their smartphone so they don't even have to interact with the keypad anymore. But it depends on the user's preference. There are substantial benefits to using a keypad that are not available through smartphones. For example, if you were to arrive at home in a very scary situation, God forbid this ever happens to anyone, if someone were to force you into the home, a hostage, duress, home invasion type situation, and they say, turn the security system off, the gun to your head, knife to the throat, scary situation. If you type in your normal code onto the keypad or your phone, it's going to disarm the system and you would be at the hostage taker's mercy. But having a physical keypad on the wall gives you the ability to enter an alternate hostage duress code. When you enter this alternate code into the system, it disarms the security system. The burglar has the appearance that they're off the hook and you're at their mercy, but that hostage duress alternate signal sends a silent emergency signal to the monitoring facility. When we receive that, you cannot false alarm that. You have to manually type in that alternate signal, and we would dispatch the police right away. Normally, the local police departments treat that blue lights flashing. It's a higher prioritization in the response to the residents. Mm-hmm.
So now, how do you guys keep up with all the new technology? Because now there's, you know, you can go to Costco and buy what appears to be an alarm system.
Yeah, there's a lot of technology that's saturating the industry. You have professionally installed equipment, do-it-yourself DIY equipment, monitor-it-yourself MIY equipment. But when it comes to security, you want a professional company doing this. I would not work on my own brakes. You want a professionally trained, licensed technician working on your brakes. The same thing applies to your security system. You wouldn't perform dental surgery on yourself. Have the professionals do it and do it right. Don't take those chances and gamble with the protection of your family and your business. But when it comes to the technology itself within that, you know, option space, we keep up with the technology by constantly maintaining relationships with the core manufacturers within the market, within the industry. We go to annual conferences such as ISC. I went out to Vegas earlier this year, and the ISC conference is a very impressive technology conference.
That's security?
Yes. It's an international security conference, mm-hmm. Everything from video surveillance to alarm systems and everything in between. We stress test all the options before we would release anything to the public to make sure that they have the lowest possible fail rate on any product, the best warranties, and that it's been, you know, stress tested and trial tested in-house. That way we keep our customers protected with the latest and greatest at a very affordable, you know, option available to protect their homes and families.
So any technology that's out there that you can do it yourself, there's an Ackerman blessed version that they provide?
Ackerman doesn't do it yourself with anything. Everything that we monitor, we install.
Right, but you have the same technology that a person that could go on their own and buy something that solves a problem?
Not necessarily. There are some equivalents within the DIY or MIY product options in the security and alarm spaces, but there are a number of products and technologies that are only available to dealer programs. So if you're going to work with specific types of products and services, you cannot do those yourself. You have to get those from a licensed, you know, company who can come out and install them.
So now, what are some of the latest technologies? Like you mentioned the electronic locks. Do you have like any videoing or things like that?
Video verification is becoming more popular. Video services in general, over the years, we've seen more and more of those types of services. We have some products that allow customers to have Wi-Fi cameras installed for a very reasonable one-time installation cost, and the resident at the home can actually look in live and see what's going on at their home, but they also have the capability of continuous recording, pushing notifications to the phone, and in the event that there's an alarm event, it automatically ties in with the security system, so it pushes those video clips and those recordings to the account holder, the subscriber, the family at that house, in the event of an alarm.
Now, does it play nicely with like existing technology I might have in the house already?
It does. We specialize in working with most major manufacturers. Ackerman's model is very different in that we don't require a new security system for every customer who comes our way. We can frequently work with the equipment that's at their home.
And even if it might be a competitor brand?
Especially if it's a competitive brand or someone who's currently being monitored by another company. There's many people that are unaware that their systems are open platform. So if you're currently monitored by a company other than Ackerman Security and you were interested in switching the monitoring to Ackerman, we likely can use your existing system. In most cases, there's little to no out-of-pocket cost to switch the monitoring service over, and you can begin monitoring with us for as little as $19.95 a month.
And then can you, if you're like, oh, I want to upgrade this or like you, it's not just security. Like, could it be like carbon monoxide or other services?
That's a great question. So when you go back to the comment previously made about false alarms, 99% of these situations are false alarms. Those 1% of the pie chart that are live emergencies within the industry, do you know what the most common response requirements are?
No.
Fire. Believe it or not.
So like a smoke detector, you monitor that as well?
Correct. So our security systems that we monitor can integrate with alarm monitoring for heat and fire smoke detectors. These are different than the builder code smoke detectors that are installed in the home. These are different grade, different placement within the home, and they're always on. Even if people do not arm or disarm the security system, the fire monitoring is always actively monitored. So, for example, if you're away from your house or working outside in the yard and your security system was disengaged, it's not actively going to set off the alarm, the smoke detectors are still
working.
On. So if there were to be a fire, an electrical fire in the house, it would immediately dispatch the fire department out to the home. So we integrate with those life safety devices as well, and it's highly recommended because you get additional insurance discounts depending on who provides the homeowner's insurance to your home, just by having monitored fire devices in the home. And statistically, it's more likely to be of a benefit to you than the burglary elements on the system design.
Now, these are typically wired into your system where you don't have to remember batteries and things like that, right?
We can do traditional wired devices that are powered from the main security system, and we also have wireless options available. There are pros and cons either way. But even if you had to use wireless devices in options where there is no wire access available, the battery-powered RF wireless devices usually have a lifespan of 3 to 7 years, depending on the manufacturer.
And do you have any tips for homeowners that can make them feel safe and discourage burglars, things like that?
There's a lot that we can do to discourage burglars. In system automation, one of the ways that we show that there's the appearance of someone at home is integration with exterior lighting. If people leave and go out of town on vacation and they flip on their front porch lights, but the lights are on all day long.
Right, 24/7.
24/7, it's pretty obvious that you just left the lights on before you left town. And by the way, you probably have 4, 5, 6 newspapers stacked up on the driveway. So it's important to work with your neighbors, be good neighbors to one another, help collect mail for one another while you're out of town. And with system automation, the lighting can actually have communication and commands pushed by the security system. So the security system can say, we're going to turn the lights on at 7:30 p.m. in the winter, for example, and then it's going to turn off at 5 a.m. the next morning. So there's the appearance that someone is at home, turning on the lights, turning off the lights. So creating the visual impression that someone is at home is very important to deter burglars. In addition to the yard signs, the stickers, we recommend during the holiday season, which is coming upon us very quickly, it's right around the corner, if you buy any flat screen televisions, expensive electronics, jewelry, anything like that, break the boxes down, put them inside black non-transparent garbage bags when you leave them out on the side of the street.
Right.
If you bought a 50-60 inch flat screen television and you left the large box sitting on the side of the road,
that's like a billboard.
It's an invitation for right. a break-in. So just make those smart, wise decisions. Lock your doors, arm the security system, and keep a fresh yard sign in the front of the home.
Now, are most burglaries just people just randomly walking down a street looking for what they think is vulnerable, or are they really casing the house to see if the lights are going on at certain times and if someone's really there?
In the 12 years I've been with Ackerman, I have seen a spectrum. You get your neighborhood teenagers that are up to no good, too much time on their hands. Idleness is not a good thing for them, and they're going to break into the homes and steal the cash, little petty things around the home. But we do, within the industry, we do see rashes of break-ins where people will break into the cars outside of the home. They'll break into the house, the would-be cat burglars, and it appears to be a more professional-type situation. It's important to have wireless cellular monitoring on the security system as a backup and a fail-safe, because most security systems are monitored through a telephone line or cable internet, and those wires are exposed outside your home.
Right.
So if a professional burglar is going to break into your home, they cut those wires outside your home before they break in.
Mm-hmm.
And the alarm system, even though it'll initiate a siren and make loud noise, the alarm signal never makes it to the monitoring facility.
Right, because it's cut.
But with the cellular wireless communication, you have that additional protection and backup. I remember being at a property years ago when I had first started with Ackerman, working my way up in the company, and I was working with a customer who was very hesitant to share any reasons for visiting with Ackerman. And we went through the system design process and the consultation, and he later, after activating the service with me, said that the reason he was switching companies was because his prior monitoring company, I'm not going to mention their name, did not have cellular monitoring on his account. He actually had his entire house cleared out while his family was away on vacation. These are the rare situations, but these are the nightmares that become a reality, a statistic for people out there. You don't want to become a statistic, but in his situation, he came home with his family from vacation, and his house was literally cleared out. Empty, a vacant home like it was on the market for sale. One of his neighbors said that a moving truck had pulled up onto the driveway, and there were people in professional mover uniforms that were coming in and out of the house and just cleared everything out of the house. They thought it was a legitimate operation.
Right, they thought they were moved.
They didn't know, because they cut the wiring outside the home. The signal never made it to the monitoring facility.
Now, what about putting like a dog bowl outside and things like that? Does that work?
It sure can be a deterrent, depending on the dog. Some dogs you might think would be a good deterrent, but if you've ever watched shows like To Catch a Thief, they have many cases where homeowners think their dogs would be a strong deterrent. Pit bulls, German Shepherds, whatever vicious dog you want to think. And the burglars will break into the home and give them a dog treat. They'll give them beef jerky, and in some cases, they'll injure or kill your pet. They don't care. These are criminals.
Right.
They don't come into the house with the same code of moral compass and ethics that the regular homeowners have. So if you think that your dog is going to deter a burglar, probably not. And many people would say, I have guns at home, I don't need a security system. Well, I've also visited with people who had that prior mentality, and they bought an alarm system because when they came home from work, a burglar was in their home pointing their own gun in their face. So if you are a gun owner, who's protecting the theft of your guns while you're away from home?
Right. You can't be there all the time.
That's right.
So now, if somebody wanted to learn more about Ackerman, what's the best way to get a hold of you guys?
770-552-1111 or visit us at AckermanSecurity.com.
And then is there something that for Ackerman, you cover the metro Atlanta area, but you have offices all over the country, right? Or actually even beyond that?
We have accounts nationwide in all 50 states and some of the shared U.S. protected territories, but we actually have a few select offices within the Southeast. Our headquarters is here in Atlanta, Georgia, in the Norcross area. We've been in this market since 1967 with well over 125,000 customers right here in Metro Atlanta. We are the largest residential security provider in Metro Atlanta, and we're that sign of trusted protection. But we do not have residential account coverage in all 50 states throughout the country at this time. We are expanding, but the majority of our accounts at this time are in Georgia, Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. for our residential service footprint, and we are expanding.
And that's AckermanSecurity.com's website.
AckermanSecurity.com.
All right, Chris Bean, thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Thank you so much.
Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we got Tracy Woodward with iDrum Gallery. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, tell us about iDrum. How are you serving folks?
So iDrum Gallery is a contemporary gallery in downtown Atlanta, and we have music and art and live theater and just trying to activate spaces all over downtown Atlanta to try to bring people into the city and show that there's great things happening with Atlanta artists outside of just the High Museum.
Yes, there is. Now, how are you defining art?
Excellent question. Well, for example, some of the things that we've been working on this year, we've had a silent film series. We had one at the Plaza Theater where we take old black and white films like Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, Alice in Wonderland, Dante's Inferno, and we score music with rock bands.
So you, an artist did that?
Yes.
They did that mashup.
Yeah, they did. Yes. And those were with all Atlanta musicians. But the idea is that we're bringing art films that have been around for a long time. These are like classic German surrealist films, but giving it a new edge and making it a little more fun.
And then so are they public domain films?
Absolutely.
So then that way they can have access to it, the musicians can have access to it and use it how they see fit.
Absolutely.
Now, so your iDrum is a place where this kind of weird mashups occur. You're not like we do sculptures with horses.
Well, right? You'd be amazed some of the sculptures that we've been doing. We're actually looking to move into a new space downtown. Used to be a movie studio, so we're going to be turning that into a new event space. But right now, we are curating events in gallery spaces all over Atlanta because we're trying to reach a very broad audience. So, for example, on September 21st, we're going to be having a string quartet performance with interactive theater at the DK Gallery over on Marietta Square. We're going to be having the 20th anniversary event at the Metropolitan Lofts on Metropolitan Avenue and Ralph David Abernathy, and that's going to be a bunch of Atlanta bands, everything from new wave to goth to 90s rock.
So the name's iDrum, so it's sound and visual?
Yes, it's everything.
So anything goes?
Everything goes.
And then are you the creator of iDrum?
I'm a board member, but I'm curating the classical music events.
So you're the classy one?
I'm the classy one.
So tell us about, like, what drew you to that?
Well, I did my undergraduate at Georgia State University, and originally iDrum was right down the street from Georgia State. And, you know, if you're studying at GSU, you're constantly having to do new music, whether that's jazz or art music or some combination of the two. And what I felt was the problem is that there weren't really low barrier event spaces for people who wanted to do something that wasn't just grandma's NPR. And that's what I really love about it. And I think what the audiences really love about it is that, I mean, you know, classical radio stations are great, but it's like sort of the same 40 songs over and over again. And if you want to hear something that's a little edgier and a little more fun, oh, and by the way, I can have a beer while I'm watching the string quartet, you can do it at places like iDrum.
Now, for you, have you traveled around the country to different...
I've traveled all over the world at this point.
Okay, so you've traveled in a lot of different places. Now, how would you define Atlanta's art scene?
Atlanta art scene...
I mean, you keep mentioning the Hive Museum, and I think that that's not the brand you'd like for Atlanta.
No. I mean... Don't get me wrong. Hive Museum does some really wonderful, lovely
stuff.
But
they're the NPR of art.
Well, how about this? Okay, how about this? It's like if a tourist comes to Atlanta and say they're only going to the Hive Museum, that would be like saying, I'm only going to eat food at Bacchanalia. Bacchanalia is the best of the best. But, you know, we got other lot of places you can visit. And what I feel sets Atlanta apart from other art scenes versus New York versus Chicago versus Portland or the Bay Area is that, like, you go to New York and L.A., and if you want to be an artist, the first thing you think is, okay, how can I be exactly like whoever's making the most money right now?
Is that true? That's a little cynical.
Oh, it's absolutely true. It's very homogenous in the bigger cities, whereas Atlanta art, you know, there's more of a spectrum, this feeling. It's like, well, that's okay. I'm going to do my thing, and it's okay if it's different from your thing, and there's more variety. I mean, if you look at the artists that are coming out of here, you have like Tyler Perry Studios, you have Childish Gambino, you have just a wider variety of music than if you were in the more expensive cities.
Right. So from a music standpoint, we have more eclectic tastes. So you
yes.
can have country music to Childish Gambino.
Exactly.
Right. In the same city. And so we cover kind of the gamut there.
Exactly.
You feel good about that.
Exactly.
Music wise. Right.
Yes.
So now you're trying to get the visuals to kind of.
To match up with that.
Right.
Yeah. And again, Atlanta, because we're a very international city, we're able to have all kinds of things offered to us. We have, for example, we have, you know, the Living Walls Project where, you know, Atlanta people were going down to Miami and pulling South American artists through Art Basel in Miami and bringing them into Atlanta to have public murals and to fill up public spaces with art. We're bringing.
Are you seeing that happening now?
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
like Wynwood in Miami has a whole area that's just dedicated to that.
Well, and Atlanta's doing the exact same thing. If you walk down Edgewood Avenue, you have about a mile stretch of public art. And it's such a pleasant experience because the art is sort of broken up with little spaces that you can stop for a break. So it's like, okay, I'm going to look at this art. Then I'll stop for an ice cream cone. Then I'll look for some more art. And then I'll have a beer with my friends. And it's just a pleasant, strolling experience that also invests in local business.
Now, can you make a business case that this is good for the community to do this?
This is absolutely great for the community. One of the best examples that I've seen of a small southern town investing in the arts would be Huntsville, Alabama. Huntsville's not a big town. It's maybe 5,000 people, mostly defense contractors. And
Right. It's a very affluent town, though.
Yes.
It's
well,
not the typical small southern town.
No, but they have the problem in that they are trying to retain professionals who are coming from bigger cities. So they've invested heavily in theater, the opera, the symphony, the art museum, because these are people coming from places that are used to having a lot of culture.
Right.
And so Atlanta downtown population is scheduled to grow just exponentially over the next 10 years. And so if you invest in art, you're going to retain similar professionals who might otherwise have moved to Portland, San Francisco and New York.
Now, I'm a big believer in the arts, 100%. And I wish there was more that that we did to support the arts. Now, it breaks my heart that we're having a conversation about the importance and how it helps economic development, all that stuff on one hand. And then the other hand, we're saying, yeah, let's get rid of that for all the children and not have art for kids in the elementary schools.
And that is true. And one of the things is that you have struggling schools downtown, and so there's more of an emphasis on STEM because they're like, oh, well, STEM jobs will pay
a lot.
Yeah, but you're sort of taking the beating heart out of everything. And that is something that we do try to focus on is, like, when I curate events, I try to do something that you can bring the family to. And, you know, for example, the silent films. Like, we did Alice in Wonderland, and that was something, you know, it was an hour-long film, starts at 7:30, ends at 8:30. It's not on a school night. And that's something you can take the kids to.
Right.
And the kids know the story.
Exactly.
But at the same time, because it's a silent film and there's music, you're engaging them creatively.
It allows them to connect dots in ways that they – Like, it doesn't have to be this. Like, you can see one thing and it can be that, but it can also be something totally different.
Yeah, exactly. It's not entirely passive.
Right. So that's an important skill for children, I think.
The other really great interactive thing that I actually brought my six-year-old daughter to, and she loved this so much, but we have an artist that we use all the time named Amanda Gray Plattner, and she did a five-day installation called Matriarchy. It was amazing. She took a building, and it was her and two other women, and for 5 days, they were constantly painting on three walls and the floor and themselves, and they were not allowed to speak for 5 days. So every communication had to be through physical gesture or facial expression, but the audience members were allowed to come in and paint on the surface as well and interact with them non-verbally. And at first I was like, oh, I don't know, is my six-year-old going to be down with this? And my six-year-old was like, yeah, I'm down with this. And it was just such a wonderful moment to, as a mother, to see my child interacting with art in such a way.
Right. And then where there is a place where they can do that, where it isn't just, like you said, passive, where I just sit in here and walk down through rooms and see pictures for, you know, 100 years
yeah,
ago.
Yeah, I'm staring at photos of naked women next to a bowl of fruit. Exactly.
Right. Like, how much of this do we really need? Now, for you, what excites you about the Atlanta scene? I know you're fired up about the music.
There's a lot of great music these days. There's just a lot of great art that is trying to engage in a conversation with the audience. One of the events that we have coming up at DK Gallery is we're doing Shostakovich's Eighth String Quartet with interactive theater. So what that means is there's going to be actors, and we're going to get permission from some of the audience members to do this. But during the performance, certain audience members are going to be pulled and put through a KGB-style interrogation, because when that quartet was written in the 50s, it was during the really scary time of Russian fascism, and that's a part of history that a lot of our younger audience members don't really have. They don't remember the Cold War. They don't remember this part of history. And so by having this sort of small bit of theater, they can see it's like, this is where the art came from.
Right, the suffering that was required in order to make the art.
Exactly.
And there's a lot of times there's a disconnect where the person doesn't understand the context from which the art came.
Exactly. And so by having this sort of cross-pollination of media, you can start those conversations with younger audience and keep them engaged.
Now, are you seeing more and more Atlanta artists embrace kind of the social activism of part of art?
Absolutely. There's another artist downtown, Julio Mejia, who was ex-military from Peru, and he does a lot of art, like at Fort McPherson, and he does a lot of art installations that use like body bags and bullet casings and stuff like that, because oftentimes the idea of war is this distant problem, and he's trying to bring it home and say, no, this affects us now.
Now, what suggestions would you have or recommendations for? A lot of developers and builders listen to our shows. How would you suggest that they embrace the arts instead of making these kind of cookie cutter buildings and work life play areas that, you know, they all have a kind of a similarity to them where they don't really have to?
Right. Well, you know, one of the good, bad issues with Atlanta is we have a lot of foreclosed properties downtown, and a lot of the landowners are like, are in a situation where it's like, okay, I have retail space. It's not going to be attractive maybe for another 10 years, maybe because it's one retail space surrounded by a bunch of, you know, other empty buildings. And if they would just let artists in, and let artists, you know, activate that space. I mean, as long as it's up to code, artists can do a lot with that and make it attractive and also make it safer for the neighborhoods, because artists tend to use their event space at night.
Right.
And if you're activating spaces at night, there's going to be less crime.
Now, do you find that that's helped the growth of the downtown area?
Absolutely. There are gallery spaces. For example, there's Blue Mark Studios on Jefferson Street. There's Gallery 992 and Ralph David Abernathy. There's the Metropolitan Loft Studios. All spaces in neighborhoods who want this because they want culture, they want nighttime activities, and they want sort of the cool factor where they live and something that they can enjoy that's in walking distance from their homes.
Now, how do you attract the artist?
Sometimes we put out a call for submissions. Oftentimes, artists are seeking us out because artists just want a space where they can have their music, have their stuff put on walls.
So now, but a certain type of artist comes to you, right?
Right. Well, and again, we're working typically with low barrier entry artists. These are people who are coming fresh out of SCAD, fresh out of Georgia State, and kind of want to dip their toe in the industry, or they're doing something that is so edgy for the Atlanta community that they maybe tested on us first to make sure that it's like, okay, is this, are we going to get eyeballs for this? You know, we'll start here, and then from there, they work their way around the art community elsewhere in Georgia.
But what's the kind of the business case for an artist? Like, how do they make money typically?
Well, if they're a musician, then they sell albums. And that's actually really easy because of the advent of the internet, is they give a live performance and they say, oh, by the way, I got a new album. You can go get it on iTunes. It's $10.
So that happens that way.
That happens all the time. If they're a visual artist, then they have another variety of things that you can do straight through the internet. Some of them do live illustration, and then what you do is you pay for a digital subscription once a month just to watch the artist, like, literally doing illustration or doing painting on the internet. That's a wonderful service you can do from the comfort of your own home. You can purchase prints online. Sometimes it's just T-shirts and mugs, but there's a lot of things that you can do very easily whether or not you're going into the gallery space.
Now, do you think that there's more ways for an artist to kind of finance their art nowadays?
Mm-hmm. Well, for sure, there are commissions, and that is one of the great things that Atlanta is doing, is hiring more public muralists through Living Walls. There's going to be a series of murals. There's a new tunnel, I think, very close to here, like a pedestrian bridge, where they're going to be putting in murals. Mercedes-Benz Stadium is hiring muralists. And again, this is great because it becomes a public good. It's not just something, it's like, oh, well, between 9 and 5, you can pay the ticket price right to see this painting.
But how come there aren't more of that just everywhere, like on the sides of, they have highways that have those barriers. Why can't we be painting on those things and underneath the overpasses and things like that?
That's an excellent question. No, I would love to see art everywhere. You know, one of the things
that... But what would be the reason that, is it the government says no, or they're not going to fund it, or what would be a reason not to have it?
That is an excellent question. And, I mean, you could go into a lot of different issues. I mean, and I think a lot of it is just cultural. Like, you know, you go to Paris and it's everywhere because it's assumed that there's going to be public art. And I think part of it is that people have an uneasy feeling drawing a line between public art and graffiti.
Right.
Right. And so people just want that to be very well defined, depending on the part of Atlanta you're in, because some people will give the artist complete freedom and say, here's a wall, here's $1,000 and some paint cans, do what you want.
Right.
And some people want a little more control over the art that is going to be in their public space.
But that's a negotiation at that point, though.
Exactly. Yeah, but there is a class issue, because a lot of people, they see any art on a public wall and they think, oh, it must be graffiti. And so you have to have that public discussion with the neighborhoods and say, oh, no, this is art.
Right.
Right? This is not meant to devalue the property.
But it becomes part of your brand. It becomes part of the culture of the community.
Right. Well, and again, I think you're reaching an age barrier, because the younger people want public art and the older people see it as vulgar. And so, again, we need to have
that
discussion.
Vulgar?
Yes.
Vulgar.
Vulgar.
That somebody has told you that?
Yes, because public murals are an urban thing and not a suburban thing, if that makes sense.
So you've had these conversations.
I have had these conversations. I have talked to people in Brookhaven about murals, and they don't want it because they say that's a city thing.
A city. So Brookhaven isn't a city.
No, apparently not with some of the people living in there. But again, it's because some people value uniformity.
Right.
Right. And they want all the houses to look the same, and they want all the buildings to look the same.
But they need to have some quirkiness, because then that's what brings the people to
them. Oh, no, you're preaching to the choir. I want there to be quirkiness. I want there to be art everywhere, but you do have to sort of sell the value of it. And for some people, that is a new concept.
So are you bullish or pessimistic about the situation?
Well, I believe that we just have to have a conversation and find what people are comfortable with as far as art and what value they take from it.
But that's a moving target.
Yes. Well, everybody's different. You know, Atlanta's a big city with a lot of small populations all over the place. And that's why, you know, again, one of the things that iDrum is trying to do is go to where the gallery spaces already exist. Like, it could be downtown, it could be midtown, it could be Marietta Square, and find what art is most propitious for that population.
And then just give them what they need.
Well, I mean, we do try to push the envelope, but, you know, I try to have a good sense of situational awareness and find, you know, what can we get away with? What kind of conversation can we have with them? Because people want to have a good time. Right. But on the other hand, you do want to expand their horizons, but you don't want to expand them so hard and so fast
that they all leave.
Exactly.
It's a balance. So now for you, you don't have a permanent space right now, or you're working on it?
We're working on a permanent space.
So it's forced you to be nomadic a little bit.
Yeah. For the last few months. Yeah.
And there's some benefits to that.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, we are looking at an industrial space that had been a movie studio, because we do want to remain rooted in downtown Atlanta.
Right. But are you going to now, once you get rooted again, still do these kind of nomadic ventures where you're adventuring out?
Absolutely, because we want to have a satellite circuit of art galleries where once we have an artist at our gallery and they want to move on to different spaces, they can make that little satellite route.
Little circuit.
Exactly.
iDrum circuit.
Exactly.
So you're working on building that out now, or that already exists?
Well, it already exists. There are a number of galleries here in Atlanta. You have the Atlanta Contemporary, you have MoCA, you have the Museum of Design of Atlanta. You have all these places that cater to certain areas of the art community, and we want all of them to cross-pollinate as much as possible so the artists can get as much exposure and as many eyeballs on their work as possible.
Now, has the film industry dramatically helped the situation, or is it more driven by the music industry?
The music industry has certainly made a lot of changes. It has made the most changes on the production side of things. A lot of people who would normally be carpenters, electricians, people who make cups of coffee, they are getting a lot more work. And a lot of the industrial spaces that might have stayed empty, these could be old factories, old houses, old parking garages, are being used for the film industry. It's been terrible for actors, because all the actors who are coming in from New York and LA.
They're flying them in and out.
Exactly. The talent is coming from out of town. But for the production side, it's actually been great, because the studios find these factories and maybe bring them up to code, and they do a movie for about a year, and it's like, okay, we don't need this anymore. And so it has made it a lot easier for artists to come in and say, oh, it's empty again.
Right, and it's 80% built.
Yeah, and the lights are on. Yes, right. Exactly.
So now, so you have the film industry, you have the music industry, the gaming. Is this the art world touching the gaming industry as well?
Oh, I wish it did. It's funny. I mean, the gaming industry, for music, it has certainly been productive, because the gaming industry has been producing film soundtracks here. So for video game and film, that's been great. VR has definitely come up. I've been actually beta testing VR games up in Cobb County. But it's... You know, video games is like the movie industry, is extremely expensive. And also, if you're going to be doing indie gaming, that's sort of a kind of industry you can do from anywhere. So I wouldn't be able to speak to that as much in the city of Atlanta.
So, but there's a lot, it seems like there's a lot of ways to commercialize an artist's lifestyle here in Atlanta.
There is. But again, people need to know that it's out there, because again, people know about the High Museum because it's highly visible, but there are hundreds of gallery spaces all over Atlanta that people don't know about.
Is there a place where you can kind of, is somebody curating all of the, you know, artistic opportunities that's out there?
No, there's no one like chief of executive of small independent art galleries in Atlanta.
I'm not saying that there's a person in charge of it, but somebody's like, hey, here's a website that lists the 100 different galleries. There's nobody that's curated.
Oh, I wish. I wish there was a phone book for all the art spaces in Atlanta. I mean, for sure, the easiest thing you can do is go to any one of these art spaces like Atlanta Contemporary, MoCA, iDrum, Gallery 992, Metropolitan. And then once you're at that art space, you talk to the artist. You talk to the curator and say, hey, what else is going on this week?
Right. So, like, you know of the things that are interesting to you.
Sure.
And then every gallery owner knows the things that are interesting
to them. Yeah, because they're all friends.
But nobody is kind of putting them all under one place to go, hey, here's the 200 art galleries that are open this weekend.
No, I mean, to be honest, when I'm looking for an independent art event for something that is sort of outside my wheelhouse, I just go on Facebook and go hashtag art show. Because, I mean... I mean, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, that's how people are promoting it because it's a free platform. But no, Atlanta definitely needs to do a better job of promoting these independent art events.
Right, because they're happening literally every day.
Yeah, they're happening all the time. And it's always cool stuff. I mean, and a lot of times, like, there's another place called White Space, which is over off of Edgewood in the Inman Park neighborhood, which is this lovely house. And there's a carriage house. And she hosts amazing film events that you wouldn't know about except that she's friends with my mother-in-law, right? And so, yeah, I think it is an issue that we need to do a better job of promoting these smaller spaces.
Right. So if somebody wants to know what's happening at iDrum Gallery, where do they go?
They go to iDrum.org. So that's EYEDRUM.org. And you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
And what do you need more of? More artists, more money, more donations, more corporate support. What do you need?
We need more people in the room.
More people
in
the room.
We need more people in the room.
That solves all the problems.
Yeah. I mean, well, you know, like I said, the big event is going to be October 20th at the Metropolitan Lofts, and that's the one we're going to have a lot of amazing Atlanta artists. But like I said, we're going to have more shows at the Plaza. We're going to have more shows at the art galleries. We just need people to show up. Have a good time.
And if you're an artist that has an interesting idea, and they should reach out to you. You're open to having conversations with artists as well?
Absolutely.
All the time?
All the time.
You never get tired of that.
I have the number of people who call me up at 3 a.m. and say, I got this brilliant plan. Let's drop everything for the rest of the weekend. I get those phone calls.
Is that good?
It's the best feeling in the world.
All right. Tracy Woodward, iDrum Gallery. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you for having me.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Katie Galley. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.